Gail Johansson and Daniela Gongora are both violinists and teachers, but they've made music in vastly different areas. Gail Johansson lives in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Right now, since it's almost the winter solstice, we have less than 4 hours of daylight. You know, it's dark most of the time. The real difference is that daylight swing. In the summertime when we have institute, it never gets dark. So it's light all night long. I remember one time looking out my window and my neighbors were planting trees in their yard at 2 a.m. The other day, I'm teaching a lesson and a moose walked by my studio window. And so the student said, "Oh, a moose." And we all stop and admire it.
And Daniela Gongora grew up in Belize.
Oh, it's so good. It's like heaven. I mean, the water is just very clear. You're on the boat and you see just this sea of crystal green. It just puts you in a state of zen because it's just beautiful. So, you know, everybody goes and they have chicken tacos if they want, or they go to the other guy who has small little mini meat pies, which is much more of a British influence. Some of the houses, you know, the backyard, a mango tree in there, or a lime tree.
Though Daniela and Gail came from different geographical areas, they both thrived in their small music communities. What did it take for them to create excellence when resources were limited? Are there lessons for all of us, even if we live in a community of abundance? You're listening to Building Noble Hearts, a production of the Suzuki Association of the Americas. I'm Margaret Watts Romney. Here, we take a look at the learning environments in which children, parents, and teachers gain new knowledge and are encouraged to become fine individuals. Throughout this season, we're talking with people whose lives intersected the work of humanitarian violinist Shinichi Suzuki, and we're finding themes of good teaching everywhere. Themes like community, independence, and spreading a vision of excellence. Gail's small music community in Fairbanks, Alaska is pretty isolated, and when students need a new instrument,
They have to call and ask for several to be sent. Even chin rests and shoulder rests. I mean, you have to ask for about half a dozen to be shipped to you and then send back the ones you don't like. Because here we are in the middle of interior Alaska. The next city is Anchorage, and it's a 7-hour drive away. So if you want something to happen, you have to do it yourself.
Gail grew up in the land of plenty and the land of 10,000 lakes, immersed in music in Minnesota.
I remember my mother made sure that we got piano lessons starting in first grade. In third grade, I remember somebody coming to my classroom and playing the violin. And I went home and asked my parents, and they said, sure. I remember I really wanted private lessons. 3 times I asked, and finally my dad said, yep, I think we can do that.
She was first exposed to Suzuki teaching in high school.
Well, I remember that I was an usher in high school for the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and they brought Dr. Suzuki and his tour group in for a regular subscription concert. And I remember even having like feelings of jealousy, like, wow, how did they do that?
She just happened to be in the right place at the right time to witness the seeds of a new music philosophy being planted in the United States. She didn't pursue Suzuki philosophy for a few years, but serendipity hit again when she was in graduate school at the Cleveland Institute of Music. She just happened to come across a book, and it resonated with her.
I remember in graduate school at CIM just happening upon the book Nurtured by Love in the music library. And I remember that I couldn't put it down, that I thought, this really resonates with me. And I read the whole thing cover to cover that night.
Gail enjoyed her musical education in grad school, which was enriched by attending Cleveland Orchestra concerts, where she could attend for free as a student.
I went every weekend and heard that wonderful music. And of course, that does a lot for your standards and for your expectations of what can be done in music when you hear that kind of world-class music every week.
Meanwhile, Daniela Gongora's early music community was in Belize City, but finding experts in classical music when she was growing up was not easy.
We didn't have, you know, teachers at a high skill level to help us move ahead. We started a little chamber group. You know, it was everybody. You know how to play the cello? Let's play Pachelbel's Canon. Oh my gosh, we would rehearse weeks and weeks, months, and always it would fall apart.
Music was abundant in Daniela's early years, first with piano and then violin.
My relationship with music comes from my mom. So she played the piano by ears, but she didn't know how to read music. She would always play on the, you know, the big LPs, you know, Tchaikovsky and Beethoven. Belize, because it was is a colony, a British colony, they had a lot of pianos that were brought in. So when some of the British left, you know, they left a lot of pianos back. So piano was the big instrument. Everyone would, you know, learn to play the piano. So I started on the piano with this lady. We would walk there, and then we saw another student with this case. It's this violin case. At the time, we didn't know what it was. And so my mom, she asked, and then she said, oh yeah, we take lessons at the high school. So she said, well, do you want to go take a look and see? So we went to observe the group class. And she says, is this something you would like to do?
She lived near a small school that had a budding Suzuki music education program run by her eventual mentor, Sister Therese. As a child, she didn't know exactly what Suzuki teaching meant, but she has fond memories of the experience.
Well, we had the tapes, the cassette tapes to listen to. I can recall the group classes, the private lessons, you know, playing by ear. I remembered, you know, trying to figure out Boccherini Minuet by myself. But I remember having these huge group classes, and then Sister Therese would come over and she would bring some treats for us. She'd bring like a little candy and she gives it to us at the end of the group class. I loved playing and I loved practicing, and it was truly a very nurturing environment.
Sister Therese was an enormous help in Daniela's music education, though she was not a string player herself.
Sister Therese managed to have a lot of connections either with the U.S. Embassy or with the British High Commission, because Peace Corps would come in and help, you know, do their work in Central America. But occasionally there would be someone who was doing that, but she find out that they also played the violin. So she'd say, come spend, you know, a weekend and work with these kids. And then sometimes we'd get a professor coming in from Austria, you know, so they would volunteer their time, maybe spend a year or two.
While still in high school, Daniela started teaching, but she also knew she wasn't finished being a student. The same persistence that earned her this leadership role in her school also got her a scholarship to leave Belize and study in the States.
So this philanthropist, Alan Sean Feinstein, is based in Rhode Island. He came in and he said, I am giving out 20 international scholarships, but you have to go home and you have to do something in your community in order to be nominated. And so I said, you know what, we're always raising money for the school. So let's raise some money for, there was a fire. We had raised money for, I think it was the fire victims.
So Daniela organized a concert, made money from the ticket sales, donated it all to the fire victims, and then reported on it in an application to the Scholarship Foundation.
I get this call months later. Congratulations, you're a finalist, and so you've gotten this scholarship. But you had to study in a school in Rhode Island. I'd been emailing back and forth to the professor, the head of the violin department. I said, hi, I'm Daniela, I'm the Belize student. He was tough, and you know, everyone said, you know, he was tough, but I said, hey, I'm here to to do tough. I'm here to do tough. Give it to me.
Throughout their education, these two musicians, Gail and Daniela, developed in settings that fed their hunger for personal excellence. Also, both had the desire to connect to others and teach at very young ages. Gail's first inclination to build a community through teaching began actually when she was a child.
All along, I knew that I had a real desire to teach. I think the seeds of that were when I was in grade school, my mother allowed me to invite neighborhood children in and have what I called a preschool in the basement. I remember that I made up a flyer, just a handwritten one, you know, and took it around to some of the neighborhood houses that had the younger children and told them what I wanted to do. And we put on plays and, you know, we were going to do arts and crafts and stuff like that. But I remember singing with them and I remember like putting on a musical, you know. I'm sure they thought, okay, this is going to be a short-term little thing, but I did it for 2 years.
Daniela was not quite as young as Gail when she started teaching, but as a precocious and responsible teenager at her school, she was asked to step up when a visiting British teacher was about to leave.
She was there for 2 years. At the end of that time, she was preparing me to take it over, and Sister Teresa's like, why don't you stay another year, please? She was begging her. She's like, no, Daniela can do it now. I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm 19, and what am I going to do with these kids? So that's when I started teaching, and I took over the school at that point.
Gail and Daniela taught at early ages, which showed not only their affinity to connect and nurture growth, but reflected their independence and persistence as well. Gail's background of a strong music education, a personal drive, and a desire to teach prepared her well for her new situation when she ended up moving to Alaska after her PhD program. In Fairbanks, there weren't world-class symphonies or rich music libraries or renowned master teachers like she had experienced in school, but there was a small group of teachers who had a hopeful vision to build their community with music excellence. They started after Dr. Suzuki had briefly visited.
He had been here with his tour group in 1978. And in that time, a few women who were in the symphony, they sent away for books and read all they could about how to do it and just jumped in and did it. And so when I got here, there was just a little tiny seed of a Suzuki program that they had started for their own children.
Daniela's program in Belize had started from a chance conversation on an airplane between a Catholic sister and a stranger. Sister Therese founded the school, and she too had a hopeful vision of building a community with music excellence.
She wanted to have a full orchestra. That's what she wanted. I remember her telling a story of her traveling from New Orleans. She met this person on the plane and told them about the program she would like. She got two violins donated to the cause, and then that's where it started.
Once the seeds of these small music communities were planted, they were nurtured and strengthened by the connections between individuals.
But when I got to Alaska in 1979, they were incredibly inclusive and inviting and welcoming. And I think that is really key to what pulled me in. I would say that the main thing that has been successful here is the way we have all cooperated and collaborated over the years. But the other thing that I think is unique about Alaska is many people here don't have family here. So they open their hearts and open their homes to each other in a way that you would family. And there's kind of a climate for that feeds on itself of excellence and what can be done.
It was a very, very good community, even though we only had so much. So we just took what we had and we just ran with it. I must say that it takes a village. I couldn't have done any of this without all the different people that
have come together and just shared, either if it's a minute of their time, or, you know, put me in the right direction to do something, or donated to a cause. For me, it was a village. So I felt like, you know, it was a lot was given to me from a lot of different people in different ways. And I feel like that's my way of saying thank you, is by just, you know, continuing to do good.
The collaborations and support in the community didn't just happen between individuals, but between organizations as well.
The university works well with us. The public school program works well with us. The symphony works with us. Everybody's working together in a positive, productive way. And we all feel like we're a big part of the same puzzle.
Growth in these communities was fueled by the commitment of the individuals and the connections in the community, but they gained their vision for where they wanted to grow from experiences with visiting expert teachers. Which begs the question, did these communities influence Gail and Daniela, or did Gail and Daniela's independence and persistence impact their communities? The answer is yes and yes, because humans emotionally influence each other in subtle and unconscious ways. This topic of unconscious emotional influence is explored in this clip from the podcast Two Guys on Your Head in their episode, Why Are Emotions Contagious?
How do you actually understand what somebody else is experiencing? And really, part of the way that you do that is by trying to mimic or simulate what you might be experiencing if you were doing the outward things that someone else is doing.
Yeah, and I think most of us have experienced people who we like being around them because they make us feel better, not because of what they say to us necessarily or because they're complimentary of anything, but just their emotional state sort of brings us up a little bit. And conversely, there are people who just the opposite is true, right? But one of the things that's interesting is to think about what are the channels of communication that convey this. And one of the things that we know is an outward signal of emotionality is pupil size. We know that when we're in an emotionally aroused state, our pupils tend to dilate. It's been demonstrated now, and there was a recent study that we were just looking at a little while ago, where when people see other people whose pupils are dilated, their pupils tend to dilate a little bit too in response to that, again, without any conscious awareness on anybody's part. So again, we're talking about very primitive responses that you can see would have an evolutionary advantage, because the more we understand the people that we're around, and as Art's saying, sort of simulating what someone else might be feeling or thinking like, allows us to understand more about what somebody's feeling and thinking and might be doing, you can see why those responses would evolve over time.
Doctors Art Markman and Bob Duke explain that one person's strong emotions easily spread to another, since we are wired to detect what others are feeling. Gail and Daniela's music communities were started with trust, excitement, and hope. Then, in turn, these teachers influence their communities with their own confidence, independence, and perseverance towards excellence. What are Gail and Daniela creating now and hoping for their communities next?
We've had students really go on to do wonderful things with their music. We have two musicians in the Cleveland Orchestra from our program. I mean, that alone, and I've had two students go through that Juilliard, the new program for historical music studies.
I am now doing teacher training at the University of Alaska. I know that we have a younger generation that's going to take over.
Daniela plans for more collaboration between musicians in the States and her friends in Belize, especially after the success of one visit.
And one year I also brought some of my students to work with the students there. We had a concert. We were doing the Vivaldi double. The American student and the Belizean student each, we had one on each part so that they could share that. And it was such a great experience for them. Right after they did their rehearsal, they put their instruments on and then they just went zoom together in the room and, hey, what's up? It was just like, there's just no barriers at all.
So what lessons are there from these musicians and their small communities? What are the key elements needed in order to grow to be sustainable sources of rich music education?
It's really your vision that keeps it growing and developing over time. When I reflect on how it all happened, it really is because of the inclusiveness of the atmosphere here and the spirit of collaboration and cooperation that we've been able to foster. And I think that that has allowed all of us to be greater than we would be on our own.
The positive approach to learning, that is what I think has been the success, and that's why the school is flourishing.
Though a community may or may not have a symphony, a university, music libraries, or master teachers, the most important resource a community has are the individuals who decide to collaborate, who share a vision of excellence, and who fuel each other with their love of music.
It just feels great playing. I love playing. I feel like I've evolved in why I love music and why it's important for me. You know, it's gotten from just the love of it to, hey, this is actually really important for human development. I think putting those two together is pretty unique, pretty extraordinary, and I think it's a great thing for the society and for human development, you know, in the future.
Do you have an influential person in your community, like Daniela or Gail, that you would like to recognize? Julie Schaefer, Richard Brooks, and Melissa Klein are some of the people who recently had stars named in their honor on the Giving Galaxy of Stars on the Suzuki Association of the Americas website. Go to suzukiassociation.org to dedicate a star, and we may acknowledge them here on the podcast as well. Do you have music to share? We love using music from our own community here on the podcast. Email us at podcasts@suzukiassociation.org if you would like to submit your recordings for consideration. Sun Up is composed by Stephen Katz and Derek Snyder and performed by the Snyder Cello Army. Clips from the episode Why Are Emotions Contagious are from the podcast Two Guys on Your Head and produced by KUT Radio. Toothless Slope, Borrow, and Caster Wheel Pivot are by Blue Dot Sessions and can be found at www.sessions.blue. The Vivace from the String Quartet No. 3, Opus 37 by Brahms was performed by the Cavani Quartet on the 2009 Celebrating Excellence Concert produced by the Suzuki Association of the Americas. Humoresque by Antonin Dvorak was performed by Emily Yaif, also on the 2009 Celebrating Excellence Concert. Valse, Opus 8, No. 4, is by Augustin Arios Mangor and performed by Connie Shu on the 2009 Celebrating Excellence Concert. Methuselah Podcast Productions gives masterful support to our scripts and production. You can find links on our website to all music and podcast selections. Thanks for joining us in Building Noble Hearts, and we'll see you next time.